Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to the session this morning on Cruciform Words, 2,000 Years of Hymn Text. I'm not really much of a PowerPoint person, as you will obviously see here, but we'll see if I can enhance what I have to say with a few images and maybe a few sounds as well. I've had a lot of fun, I might say, studying up on this subject. I have taught lyric poetry for decades, and that includes religious lyric, but because of the theme of the conference this year on cruciform lives and church and so forth, I thought it would be good to just look at texts of hymns and also of poems that may or may not be hymns that deal with the crucifixion and with Christ on the cross and the cross itself. And I must tell you, this is just more or less a sampler today because there is simply so much material on this subject. There are literally thousands of hymns. So at the end of this class or tomorrow's class, some of you will probably be disappointed or upset because I didn't choose your favorite hymn that would have fit the subject of the class as well or better than the ones I choose. But when you're doing a kind of smorgasbord or sampler system, this is maybe the best we can do. One of the things I want to say about these hymns and other lyric texts is that they convey to me just extraordinary devotion, deep spirituality. They also convey a lot of variety and creativity in the way people get at the story of the cross. Over and over again, these writers are trying to convey the wonder and the mystery and the awe that is inherent in the crucifixion story. And they have many different ways they get there, using various figures of speech and symbols and metaphors, allusions, hyperbole, apostrophe, on and on you go. And I'll try to give you some ideas of that. My goals for the class are to simply do some sampling and maybe whet your taste to go back and do some of your own looking to show that there has been a kind of development or evolution in hymnody associated with the cross, some very interesting changes, but also a lot of continuity. When I went into the study, I expected to see maybe significant differences, for example, between the Catholic tradition of devotional verse and the Protestant. And there are some differences, but I found a lot of commonality, too. It's not just about difference. There's enormous, strong tradition going from the Catholic way of thinking of the cross and the Protestant when it comes to at least the verbal arts. So there's a similarity between Isaac Watts, for example, and medieval hymns on the cross that we know, for example, in the form of O Sacred Head. One of the things that I see very strongly in these hymns is the desire to help the worshiper not just remember an historical event. Memory is important, but it's far more than memory. It's about re-experiencing the crucifixion, entering into the life world, you might say, of Christ on the cross. There was an article in a journal and in a newspaper this week about empathy and whether you can teach empathy and how it is that some people have more empathy than others. And the article was very strong in the point that empathy can be taught. And in the article, they interviewed a cultural anthropologist, who said that empathy is being in the heart of another person. Empathy is being in the heart of another person. And that just really hit me powerfully because it's helped you enter into the heart of Jesus through various devices, poetic figures, and so forth. So, in a sense, I might call this series Being There. Most of us know that rather famous African-American spiritual, "Were You There When They Crucified My Lord?" That is a theme throughout 2,000 years of hymn texts, of trying to take you there. Only I think in the Middle Ages they would more likely say, "Are you there?" Not just, "Were you there?" So it's more than just imaginatively leaping back to that moment 2,000 years ago, but it's actually being there in the experience. I hope that today's class and tomorrow's will do a little bit to cure our cultural amnesia. Cicero once said, not to remember what happened before you were born is to remain forever a child. A lot of us live on what Eugene Peterson calls the thin edge of the present. And frankly, that's not enough to sustain us in hard times, to live constantly only at the thin edge of the present. We need memory. We need cultural memory, spiritual memory. And hymns are very much about memory. It's one of the problems that many of us have in going to worship when every Sunday there can be a kind of a service where no memories are being stirred because everything is new. And by the way, let the record show, I'm speaking it into the microphone for posterity, I believe new hymns, contemporary hymns, can be very powerful in reaching us. So this is not a series on if we could only go back to the Middle Ages. They're over, they're done with, we're not going back there. But there's something we can absolutely learn from them. One of the things that we want to think about is the way there's been this evolution from Paul's Christ hymn, and that's where we'll begin today, all the way up to hymns that have been written within the last 5 to 10 years. One of my big points, and you can tell I'm a professor of literature when I say this, but it's just true, our faith began with hymns. Hymns preceded theology. That was said yesterday in Brother Northworthy's lesson, Luke's lesson, when he said, when Paul quotes in Philippians 2, 5 through 11, a hymn, it was a hymn the church already knew. So when Paul is writing in AD 61, 62, or 63, he's building on a hymn tradition that precedes Paul himself. It's one of the earliest examples of Christian teaching. It precedes the Gospels. It precedes the letters of Paul. Before the message, there must be the vision. Before the sermon, the hymn. Before the prose, the poem. Eugene Peterson said, isn't it interesting that all of the biblical prophets and the psalmists were poets? I sometimes have asked my students to just imagine what their Bible would be like if all the poetry were removed from the Bible. It would be a much smaller text. All of the book of Psalms, the book of Job, so many of the Proverbs, whole sections of the New Testament. There is a book out just on the hymns of the New Testament by a man named Karris, K-A-R-R-I-S. Same. So poetry precedes prose. Ben DeGioia is formerly the head of the National Endowment for the Arts and is himself a really wonderful poet. And on the NEH website, I believe it is, actually it's the Library of Congress website, he has a lecture called Poetry as Enchantment. It may not sound like it's a religious message, but it's profoundly religious in what he's saying. Dana Joya himself is an important and powerful believer. But he writes that poetry is the oldest form of literature. Indeed, it is the primal form of all literature. Poetry even predates history because it not only existed, but it flourished. Any other form of visual inscription to develop. Before writing, poetry stood at the center of culture as the most powerful way of remembering, preserving, and transmitting the identity of a tribe, a culture, or a nation, and I would add, a religious community. Poetry was the means of conveying the very heart of the faith of religious communities. Verse was humanity's first memory and broadcast technology. A technology originally transmitted only by the human body. And I want to camp on that phrase, the human body. You cannot talk about verse, poetry, hymns, without dealing with the physical dimension to it. It's much more than just words that create mental conceptions in your head. The way it works is that it washes over your whole body and changes you in significant ways. In Robert Frost's formulation, poetry was a way of remembering what it would impoverish us to forget. It is a means of remembering. One of the problems with poetry today, and the reason I'm taking time to talk about it, is that mostly English teachers have ruined people's love of poetry. You need to understand that in primitive cultures and in traditional cultures, poetry was not about something you did in a classroom. It wasn't something you read and memorized out of a book. It was a part of your daily life, your daily experience. You gathered around the fire, and you told the stories, the legends of your people, of your culture. And it was something that was intrinsic to you. And you see it in children before it gets drummed out of them in schools, the love of sounds, the love of rhythm, the love of repetition. And that's why there's Dr. Seuss and there's nursery rhymes. Poetry is innate. It's in every culture. There's no culture that we've ever found that didn't have it as a central part of its culture. It's the oldest form of literature. It's universal. And it originated as vocal music. We now, in our culture, can separate poetry from song. In the classroom, we do it all the time. We offer course after course in studying poetry, the romantic poets and all that, with no sense at all that it was really originally music. And so we still know it at the popular level, though. That's what radio does for us. Radio, I've asked students, how many of you would prefer to have a radio station or a track that was only instrumental music? And as much as people love instrumental music today, I don't find any student as the main thing. They really, really do value the lyric. And by the way, we call it lyric poetry because it used to be sung often in the ancient world to the tune or the accompaniment of a lyre. And now when I teach lyric poetry, there's no sense that it's music or it's song. But it was in the ancient world. And it was in the days of Paul and of the New Testament. So we need to see, once again, the centrality. And it was highly experiential and performative. Just this morning, I was talking to someone about how that Bono is, there's a new video out that's on the web from Fuller Seminary where he's in a conversation with Eugene Peterson. And again, it's about bringing music forward as a performance. And I think I was told that Bono says that that singing is a performance art. And we don't just mean the people on the stage. It's everyone who sings. When you really sing properly, you don't sing just with your neck up. You sing with your whole body. And we'll see some interesting examples of that. And so what we're saying here is that music in church is not just filler. It's not just the warm-up act for the sermon. It really, in many ways, is the main thing. And while I am sorry about some of the worship wars and some of the silliness and the nastiness that goes with that, the truth is people are engaged because they know at some deep level that something is really important here. Something really counts. And even if we can't quite articulate it, even if we don't have sophisticated language to explain why something is at stake here, we know in our guts something really is at stake here. And I would argue there really is. Let's come to what may be the first hymn in the Christian tradition. And it's the Christ hymn. Sometimes it's called the Carmen Christi. There are whole books that have been written on just this one hymn. It's a fascinating and powerful and beautiful hymn. I appreciate the exposition of it already this week. This is from the Jerusalem Bible, and I just give it to you sort of to give you a fresh take on it. I assume most of you don't read from the Jerusalem Bible translation daily. It's an interesting hymn because of the way it's structured. And if we were into a Greek class, we could go talk about how it became identified as a hymn by its structure. It has stanzas in it. is organized in a very particular way that identifies it as poetry. And that's why I think all modern translations now take Philippians 2, 5 through 11 and set it off as a poem that's being quoted, because there are all kinds of hints that it is poetry in the Greek. What you do find in this translation, and I think it's rather nicely done, is that it's built as a kind of parabola. And this parabola has two parts to it. And the verse down here, death on a cross, is the nadir of the parabola. So where does it start? Christ is fully God. He is with God. This text has been used to argue the pre-existence of Christ. Though he was equal with God, he didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself. And so you have the kenotic descent. And the kenotic descent is in stages. He didn't just, his first stage is to become a human being at all. Imagine the eternal one, the Word, the living Word, becoming mortal and human, taking human flesh. And not only that, but then assuming the condition of a slave or a servant. That's a stage below just being human, being made a human being. Then, humbler yet, death. Humbler yet, death in a shameful way, in the terms of crucifixion, death on a cross. And then immediately you get the but, or the however. In poetry, we call it, the turn. It's the volta, as the Italians say. There's a shift, a quick shift, but God has raised him high. And then you have the ascent on the parabola. What I've noticed in looking at hymns through the 2,000 years is that many of the hymns about the crucifixion do their very best to preserve the two halves of the parabola in the narrative. Also noticed in a lot of contemporary hymns is this gets washed away or briefly mentioned because it's all about glory. It's all about exaltation. It's all about wonderful this and that. And I would argue there's a theological problem with that. It's like churches I know that are quite happy now to have Easter services, but they don't think of doing a Good Friday service. And I would ask you to think about that. Is it possible that you rob the meaning of Easter if you skip Good Friday? We're big on Easter now. Good Friday, not so much. So as we go through some of the samples of hymns this morning and tomorrow, think about this question of the parabola and to what degree does the hymn preserve the various parts. Wayne Meeks, New Testament scholar, says that this hymn is a drama which creates community. The story of the crucifixion is a story, and it's a story of death, and it's a story of love, as many great stories are. Again, many people want to skip the death part, and they want the love part, but it's the two together. One of the things you see in medieval hymnody is the theme of Anselm, who says, with your whole mind, you must imagine yourself present and consider diligently everything done against your Lord. One medieval writer, and I forget which one, said you must build the cross by meditating on it. And so many of the devotional practices over a thousand-year period to build the cross, as it were, in your own heart. So we're going to move on to some other hymns because of time. How many of you have heard of the Odes of Solomon? Earliest Christian hymn book. Many translations are out available. When I was growing up, we used to singing out of great songs of the church. I could turn to Shepherd of Tender Youth, and it would say, earliest Christian hymn. Not. it isn't. Obviously, the Christ hymn, I would say, is the earliest Christian hymn. But now, to Christ. And at least the edition that I have, this one right here, edited and translated by James Charlesworth, he says the Odes of Solomon date at least to AD 125, or probably earlier. If you think about the fact that the book of Revelation closes, maybe was written as late as AD 96, we have a hymn book that's within 30 years or so of the close of the New Testament in Syriac. Just an amazing text to look at. I don't think the hymns in there are going to make it into contemporary Christian radio, but they really are fascinating and worth looking at. Ode 27, or Psalm 27, is in the handout there, or at least a part of it is. I didn't give you all of it. And it's called The Upright Cross. And look at what it says here. I extended my hands and hallowed my Lord, for the expansion of my hands is his sign. And my extension is the upright cross. Hallelujah. In the early church, they didn't just sing about the crucifixion. They actually physically enacted it. They performed it. So when they're taught by Jesus to take up your cross daily, they took that seriously. And that in their hymnody, this was the way it was expressed. Look at song number 42, Ode 42. I extended my hands and approached my Lord because the stretching out of my hands is his sign, and my extension is the common cross. The word common here, there's a problem with the translation, or there's maybe not a problem, but there's a challenge. It means different things. It can mean simple or erect or plain. And my extension is the simple or plain cross that was lifted up on the way of the righteous one. You'll see a lot of language about the way. The earliest name for Christianity was the way in the book of Acts, right? Leads home, but way, it has a little bit of a specific connotation that may not be obvious today. Justin Martyr, writing in the second century, was already thinking about the fact that the cross is already everywhere in nature and in creation. And he says it's in, when you look at the handle of an axe, you can see the cross. In his day, he said you can look at an anchor and you can look at masts on ships. Even the standards of the Roman, imperial army. Hence, the cross is everywhere. I see it in telephone poles all the time, I think. I wonder how telephone poles look in a non-Christian land. You know, here I just see signs of the cross everywhere. Everett Ferguson has written on this. He wrote, "Writings from the early church show how central the cross was to Christian preaching and confession." Moreover, Justin Martyr, a Christian apologist, and writing in the AD 150s and 60s, argued that God had providentially put the shape of the cross in everyday objects such as Christians would often pray, and I would add sing, because they did not sharply distinguish between praying and singing. If you're reciting a psalm or chanting a psalm, are you praying or are you singing? You do it. As you may know, in many churches in the East, there are no pews. The pew is a late invention for us lazy Westerners, I suppose. So you stand as you pray, and you sing as you pray, and you also demonstrate the form of the cross. The form of a cross. As early as the 200s, Christians were making the sign of the cross with their hands. The cross was so important that pagans charged Christians with worshiping the cross. They had to write to explain, no, we're not really worshiping the cross. We understand it as a metaphor, or it's a metonymy. It's something closely related to the thing itself. It stands for the thing that we really worship. If you can understand the meaning of a saying like, the pen is mightier than the sword, then you understand metonymy, because no one thinks that a big pen can outperform a bazooka, right? But we do understand that words are so powerful that they can change the world in the way that armaments cannot. So when you say the pen is mightier than the sword, you understand metonymy. Something closely related stands for it. The cross becomes a stand-in for who Christ is and what he did for us. Into some kind of an amulet or some kind of magic device. But the vast numbers of Christians have understood it as metonymic. As one of my Eastern Orthodox friends once said, she said, you know, if I call my granddaughter on the phone and she talks to me on the phone, and when we're done with the phone conversation, if she kisses the phone to say goodbye to grandma, do you think my 2-year-old granddaughter thinks the phone is me? No. And she said the same thing is true of how icons work. It is a reminder of what lies back of the object. It is not the object itself at all. So veneration is not worship in that sense. But the interesting thing is, and Everett Ferguson, a good Church of Christ scholar, is saying they were making the sign of the cross already in at least by AD 200. So this idea that this is a Catholic innovation, you know, or whatever, we should question that. They made the sign of the cross in the palm of the hand. They made the sign of the cross on the forehead, like that. And, of course, they made the sign of the cross with their whole bodies, as we've already seen. And then you see this showing up in the hymnody over and over again in various ways. I thought the great statue from Rio, Christ of the Americas, was a perfect illustration of this this form of lifting holy hands. And, of course, it's rather scriptural, isn't it? Paul says lift holy hands. 1 Timothy 2:8. In the Psalm 134 passage, not only does it say lift holy hands, but it says stand and lift holy hands. Now, this lifting holy hands in this way was actually a practice of the Jews, and there are versions of it in the pagan culture too. But when Christianity came along, they borrowed the practice because they thought it specifically made the point of crucifixion. So they took an existing symbol and then they reappropriated it because of the whole meaning of death on a cross. Catacombs in Rome, lots and lots of illustrations of this posture. It's called orans, which means basically something like one who is praying and pleading. And this, and you have pictures of a lot of women doing this too, by the way, not just men. Men and women are we're going to skip a couple of centuries. We've got to move on. Our time's running out. I thought I would take us to Ambrose of Milan. I don't know if you know this, but in the early church, in whole congregations, people quit singing aloud. Did you know this? St. Augustine worried about whether we should sing because he found music so powerful and so sensuous in its effect. He wondered if it might even be sinful. And didn't Paul say, sing and make melody in your hearts to the Lord? What if you take that literally? Then you turn into church into a kind of Quaker service, where it's silent worship, and you're worshiping and you're singing literally in your heart. Have you ever thought about the fact that someone who takes the Bible literally might end up not singing out loud in church? So in the Western church, singing had ceased, more or less, until singing in church. One of the most moving passages in the Confessions of Augustine is his account of the church's singing in Milan. You may remember Augustine for much of his life was kind of a hellraiser and a non-Christian and not too interested in that stuff at all. But when he heard the singing of the church in Milan, as well as the teaching, it changed his life. And so we've lost almost all of the hymns that Ambrose composed, and they didn't have musical notation, so we can't know exactly how they sang it, but it was a form of chanting, like comes from the eaves. And I thought I'd play for you the singing of one of the hymns that we do have by Ambrose from the church in Milan, which seems to be utterly perfect and proper. So we'll listen to just a few passages. few lines of it anyway. And as you listen, you might read his hymn to yourself and think about what he's saying.
Oh?
I'm not hearing it. You?
No.
We tested it a while ago, and of course it worked then. Engine, Yom Sergit Fora Tertia. And you can hear it for yourself on your own time. I'll just go ahead and stop it here with apologies. I'll get this saw for tomorrow and we'll hear some of it tomorrow. Okay.
Well, oh, wait a minute. I'll make a couple of points about this hymn. One is there were still fierce debates about the nature of Christ in this time. And so part of the hymn was used for doctrinal teaching. And so you're going to see that he asserts that Christ came in the flesh, opposing Docetus and others who challenge that notion. You will also notice that if the next to the last verse, I think, in your listing there. So we believe that God was born. His virgin birth we do not scorn. This is written in Latin, so we're not reading it as he wrote it, exactly. Sin of the world he took away. He's at the Father's right to. His only Son, and to the Spirit, Paraclete. The one in three, and the three in one. Amen. One of the things I looked for as I went through these hymns was examples of creativity, of new ways of talking about the crucifixion, because in art, you have to make it new. It's one of the great challenges for Christian artists in the 21st century. After two millennia of telling the story, how do you make it new? How do you give it a fresh take or a fresh turn? And I found the third stanza. Hour at which he ends our time of stupor from that first bad crime. So Christ on the cross is undoing the sin of Adam and Eve in the garden. And then Noah's flood gets worked in here by implication. And he destroys the world's guilt with his blood, washed out death's kingdom with its flood. So as there was one flood that cleansed the world, there is a second flood that cleanses the world. The flood is the blood of Christ. Some real creativity there, I think. Okay. Let me see if I can get this back in the right format. So we move on to something that happened in the 4th century that's rather important that I'll just mention in passing, but it's the 4th century when focus on the cross really grows in intensity. Two events. One is the famous story, the legend of Constantine about to go into battle.
He's not a Christian at this point. Christianity is not the legal religion of the West yet. But he sees the cross on October the 27th, 312. And then his good mother, St. Helen, Helena, goes and allegedly rediscovers the cross. Some of you look skeptical at this point. That's okay. It allegedly was found on September the 14th, 326. People in the Middle Ages knew there was something funny going on here. It was said that there were enough pieces of the cross all over Europe that you could build a ship, you know. But you know, there is a spiritual point behind this. A lot of people were not that naive, but they did believe that the cross in your heart was a big deal, and the focus on its importance, I think, really increased with time. You have, for example, Venantius Fortunatus, who has a beautiful hymn written in the 7th century, which you should have an excerpt from, translated in various ways. In this version, it's titled, "Abroad the Regal Banners Fly." The New Testament frequently calls the cross a tree. In fact, I was surprised when I went back and looked again at all the passages of it's frequently called a tree. And many of the hymn writers of the Middle Ages and beyond made a great deal of the symbolism of the tree. I've given you here on the screen the fourth stanza, "O lovely and refulgent tree." Adorned with purpled majesty. Purple, for many centuries in England, distinct colors. They saw it as a shade of red. In fact, the color of blood was often called purple in English literature. So the cross, the tree, is purpled, culled from a worthy stock to bear those limbs which sanctified were. And so you've got tree and limbs, a nice play there. Next stanza, "Blessed tree whose happy branches bore the wealth that did the world restore." And then you have the direct address to the cross, "Holy Cross," which you see all over the Western world now. A university is named Holy Cross, or cities like Las Cruces, New Mexico, the cross becomes a very important symbol all over Western literature and Western culture. "Hail, cross of hopes and most sublime, now in the mournful passion time, grant to the just increase of grace and every sinner's crimes efface." Again, if you remember metonymy, you know we're not worshiping the cross. We're addressing the cross as a symbol and a representation of Christ himself. Okay. Then we come up to Peter Abelard. By the way, we do have a hymn version of that. You can find it on the internet, but in the interest of time, I'm going to keep moving along. Peter Abelard, 12th century. One of the great figures of the Middle Ages, and also one of the great figures in one of the greatest love stories of all time. If you don't know the story of Abelard and Heloise, or Heloise, look it up. It's a sad and a beautiful, poignant story. But Abelard does something that I see in a lot of the hymns of this era, and that is he turns and addresses the audience, or reminds the worshiper, the singer, of what's going on, and questioning whether or not you're paying attention. There's like finger pointing coming back to you. "Alone thou goest forth, O Lord, in sacrifice to die. Is this thy sorrow not to us who pass unheeding by? Are you guilty of just walking by the cross and not remembering its meaning?" So there are a lot of hymns that have this kind of theme. "Our sins, not thine, thou bearest, Lord. Make us thy sorrow feel, till through our pity and our shame, love answers love's appeal. This is the earth's darkest hour. Present tense. You notice the present tense all through this. This is going on now. This is not just remembering something from the past. This is the earth's darkest hour. But thou dost light and life restore. Then let all praise be given thee who livest evermore. And then this wonderful passage about empathy. Empathy can be learned. That's one of the functions of the devotions to the cross, is to instill in your heart compassion. Give us compassion for thee, Lord, that as we share this hour, thy cross may bring us to thy joy and resurrection power.
The Dream of the Rue is one of the strangest and most beautiful poems in the English language. So this is the first English language text I'm giving you today. It was written in Old English. It's the same language of Beowulf and some of the other great poems from the Anglo-Saxon era. The word rude is the same word we have today called rod. It's just the spelling change and pronunciation change. And a rod in Middle English or Old English was simply a pole. And so to call it the pole was to call it the cross. As Dream of the Cross. And it's a strange kind of poem. It's a poem that's called a dream vision. And there are a lot of works of literature that are dream visions. For example, The Wizard of Oz. Someone who falls asleep. Or think of Alice in Wonderland. Someone who falls asleep. The whole idea of someone falling asleep and having a dream and then reporting the dream goes back many centuries. So in this case, someone falls asleep and they dream a dream and they see the cross. And the fusion of the cross with Christ, with the dreamer, is just an amazing movement. The poem is about 150 lines long. I gave you maybe 25 of them. It's sort of like dreams are sometimes phantasmagoric, where things are changing as you read and as you watch. For example, I saw that lively beacon, and that's his name for the cross, changing its clothes and hues. Sometimes it was bedewed with blood and drenched with flowing gore. At other times, it was bedecked like treasure. And so to me, it's really trying to capture the parabola again. So you've got the blood and the gore, the descent, and then the jewels. The jewels simply represent the beauty of redemption through Christ. But you find crosses all over Europe in this period of time, 8th century, real physical crosses that are covered in jewels. So he's probably seen crosses like this, but this is a speaking cross, and it's quite remarkable. I thought we would close with a hymn that I'm going to carry over to tomorrow, because it's a hymn that's worked again and again in every culture. Some of these hymns that I've shown you today probably wouldn't go over well in a Sunday morning service in your church. Maybe I'm selling your church short. But I do know certain hymns from the Middle Ages still work really well today. And a good example of them is O Sacred Head, Now Wounded. I don't know if you know how old this hymn is, but it goes back a long way. In many hymn books, it says that it's written by Bernard of Clairvaux. We now know that's probably not true. It's not in his corpus. It's attributed to him. But we now know that it was written by a man named Arnulf of Leuven. Leuven is now in Belgium. Salve caput cruentatum, hail bloody head, literally translated. And then it was translated into the German by a man named Paul Gerhardt in the 17th century. And it's been translated again and again and again. The version I know, and I dare say it's the version you all know, the one that begins, O Sacred Head. It really, literally, in the original was Hail, Bloody Head, crudely put. Was translated by James Waddell Alexander, an American 19th century Presbyterian minister from New York City. He also taught at Princeton for a while. But I thought that we might listen to a bit of this. The people of the village said, God, if you will spare us the plague, we will do a play on the Passion of Christ, 1630s. They survived the plague. The next year, they performed the Passion play, and they've done it
every 10 years or so since for about 400 years. The next one is in 2020. I was there in 2010. Hundreds of thousands of people come because it's performed all summer long. This part, and it's a cast of hundreds, and all the actors have to come from the village. No one, there are no ringers brought in, and the play lasts, I don't know, about 6 hours, something like that. But it's really cool. They do about 3 hours in the afternoon, maybe two and a half or so. Then they have a long break for dinner, and you go to one of the village cafes or restaurants, and then you come back in the evening for part two. Now it's in German. But you know the plot. It's really easy to follow. And they give you a playbook that has it in English on one side and German on the other. So if you do want to read along, you're there. And I'm just telling you, it's really one of the most amazing experiences. So if you have any interest in great drama and great passion plays and great music, because they do have an orchestra and a chorus and so forth with it, and one of the passages that I loved, and this happens throughout the play at certain points, when Peter denies Christ, the chorus sings to the audience, "Is this your story too?" This linkage of the story and your life is really powerful. When you're at the cross, you're asked by the chorus, "All of you who pass this way, stand still, pay attention, and see, where can one find the kind of love that can compare to this?" Inviting you into the story, inviting you to reimagine it and re-experiencing it. And so you come to this beautiful hymn that we know, which is really only one part of a much larger work. In fact, in the Lutheran hymnal, we have two verses of this hymn in our hymnal, the one I know. There are at least 10 verses. And it's really worth asking, why are the other verses omitted? What are the choices behind the omission of these other verses? And tomorrow we'll look at some of the verses that are not in our version. And maybe they're on today's handout too. I can't remember. And we'll then come up to some modern hymns too. So it's not going to be all about the Middle Ages and the Reformation, but we'll look at some 19th and 20th century hymns as well. Thanks for being here.